It's The Wonky Show. We're talking about mental health and student analytics. The rent reform bill is back in Parliament, and we discuss what should be in the refresh strategy for international students that's coming soon. It's all coming up.
I think we should make more of the... It's more than just financial. The financial point is a point well made, but the benefits to UK higher education and international student recruitment go beyond that.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and joining me to jog through the week in HE as usual, we have three fantastic guests. In Cheltenham, it's Ben Jordan, Director of Strategy at UCAS. Ben, your highlight of the week, please.
So I'm cheating slightly because it's actually last week, but I'm a big Aston Villa fan and I'm still riding high from us beating Bayern Munich.
In Chepstow, it's Jenny Shaw, Higher Education External Engagement Director at Unite Students. Jenny, your highlight of the week, please.
Yeah, so on Tuesday, I was at the second Living Black at University conference at the University of Kent, and it was just an incredible celebration of what's already been done since we published the research 2.5 years ago, but also a real call to action as well, hearing directly from Black students.
And somewhere in the deepest southwest of England, no one is quite sure where, it's David Kernan, DK to you and me, Wonky's deputy editor. Sorry, DK, higher to the week, please.
It's an obvious one from me, but back at the start of the summer, it was looking increasingly shaky if we were actually going to see any professional basketball in the UK, but the season is back and it is absolutely marvellous. So a massive well done to everybody involved in making that particular miracle happen for me.
Now, we start the week with mental health and new reports. DK, walk us through it.
This is a new report out from JISC on the idea of mental health analytics. It looks at a project that was funded by the Office for Students at the University of Northumbria with a few partners, which lasted 3 years. What they were doing was looking at all of their administrative data that they hold to see if they could find a way to predict where students might be suffering well-being or mental health problems and point them to appropriate support. Now, this is obviously, it does raise a number of questions. I mean, obviously, if we can get the support to students when they need it, that is good news for the students. It is good news for the institution that might be dealing with dwindling resources or a lack of capacity, but it also raises a lot of ethical conundrums. It's a little bit like Minority Report, isn't it? In that we are using student characteristics data to say, okay, this student is more likely to have a mental health problem. And there's a lot of issues here around consent and around actually whether students would like to know if some factor in their life that they can't control is making them more likely to have a well-being issue. Is that something they want to know about if they can't do anything about it? Absolutely fascinating stuff.
It is really interesting, isn't it? I think predictive models are always quite exciting, particularly when we're all talking about AI and thinking about what that might mean, but also a little bit alarming. And I think that the point was well made in the report that this is the support for well-being teams, not the support directly for students. So it gives them a tool. It doesn't replace what they do. It doesn't replace human judgment, but it has the ability to flag things up that they might not have seen and might not have known. I can't help thinking about whether the data architecture in most universities is ready for this. Possibly not.
Another point that's in the research.
That's a whole other thing, isn't it? But I think it opens up new avenues and new ideas. But it's about what we do with it, isn't it?
And I would agree entirely with Jenny there in terms of what we do with it. And I think maintaining student trust is absolutely pivotal. So making sure that students know what information is being collected about them, how it's being held and for what purpose. And you know, we absolutely see that with the application in terms of students wanting to know why certain questions are being asked, what it means to them and why is it relevant to their application. Because I suppose that the insight I have in this space is probably the step before the JISC report. So the application journey and what we've seen in recent years is, you know, an over 450% increase in students sharing information around their mental health in the application. But you also see quite significant subject variance. So for example, medicine and dentistry has one of the lowest levels of declaration. Now, I don't believe believe that our future doctors and dentists have a different mental health to the rest of society. I think it's due to maybe concerns or misunderstandings of how that information may be used. And one of the things that I think we need to continue working on is creating that culture of positive disclosure, people really understanding what they're being asked, why, and feeling confident in doing so to maintain that trust so more students can have the option of accessing that support should they need.
You know what, Ben, I'm always really surprised at how much students think that this data is just automatically shared. So we've seen that for 2 years now in our applicant index, just the high percentage of students thinking that schools automatically send the information to universities when they don't. So I think students are relatively relaxed about the sharing of their data and just think it's something that happens anyway. But I would like to see some social psychologists having a go at this and looking at how it changes student behaviour and what it means to students. I think students are very clued up about their mental health generally, and they're quite used to analytics. So I think there's probably a little bit more investigation into what they do with this, what it means to them, how it affects the way they think about their own well-being.
So because this is the Wonky podcast, there is a higher education policy angle on this more generally. Edward Peck's Higher Education Mental Health Implementation Task Force, which is sponsored by the Department of Education, has taken a huge interest in the whole field of well-being analytics, and also in this particular project. He does, in a recent report, he expresses the expectation that this evaluation will demonstrate it is possible to predict student well-being with accuracy, which, I mean, this report doesn't quite get there. It offers the kind of indicative prediction that is useful in targeted resources. It doesn't offer, which I think is the kind of thing that might scare a few people, the idea we could look at some administrative data and say this student will develop a mental health problem. But he does also know the sheer cost and expense in getting institutional data into a state where it can actually do stuff like this, where it can actually provide a meaningful thing. Now, Northumbria and their project, they just come off of spending a decade cleaning up every aspect of their student data operation. It was an absolutely massive job. And as anyone who works with data knows, it is really expensive. They also spent a lot of money increasing the resource they had centrally in terms of mental health and in terms of data analysis, which in the current climate is not something every institution can afford to do. Now, it is possible Edward Peck's committee could suggest that this is an approach every institution could take. Everyone should be doing this. And it is equally possible, given our previous experience of the sector, that there will be no additional money in the pot to be able to do this. I think the question for me is, if there is extra money available for student mental health above the kind of slightly depressing £50 million that's been allocated by the Office of Students, of course, then surely we should be spending it directly on student-facing services rather than mucking about with trying to predict which students are going to use those services. Isn't that more important?
I can give you a bit of an inside track on this, DK, because as you know, I do work a day a week for Edward. So what I can say, so I've not been involved in this piece of work. I've been sort of adjacent to it, but I can reassure you it's being approached with pragmatism in a nuanced way. And, you know, as one of many tools to reduce risk for students.
I think to build on your point, DK, I think what we're also seeing is a growing expectation from students that mental health support will be available within institutions and it will be high quality, etc. Again, looking back at the report that we released a couple of years ago in this space, we see that one in five students is looking researching specific support for a specific mental health condition at an institution, and one in four is looking more generally. So there is an expectation that this is part of that higher education offer. And I think, you know, thinking about this in the round of the general funding situation as well, is how institutions continue to offer that high quality support to the sector that students need and want.
And there is, I mean, interesting that you should mention that, even though we think the students expect that their data is used this way. The project in question asked students for explicit consent, as you would expect for something that was an experimental mental project at the time. Initially, it was just 61% of students who were asked to sign up at the point of enrollment, I think, chose to do this. That's gone up to about 70%, but there's still more than a quarter of students that are thinking, okay, I would like my data not to be used to do this kind of thing. So even though I think students expect that institutions are going to step in and support them while they need it, they still do have those lingering concerns that, I mean, you mentioned about the use of and the sharing of their personal data.
I think there could be an interesting piece of evaluation around what this does in terms of the relationship between the students and their institution, because it is a little bit of an invisible hand, and it's a very useful tool. It's obviously it's how it's used, but you know, there are other models in the sector, and I'm you know, with no particular hat on, I am a big fan of the London South Bank model, where it's a PDP process. It's in the hands of students. It's quite there's quite a lot of kind of freeform data, and it really kind of encourages disclosure and involvement with the institution. And I don't think the two are in opposition, but it would be just interesting to see how they sit and some of these other factors around sense of belonging and sort of linked to the institution itself.
It's all really important stuff. But I mean, just to end on a quick crunchy question to the pair of you, what do we think the chances are that something like this gets made mandatory in the sector? What are the chances that this becomes something that institutions are expected to offer to students?
Yeah, I think there's a difference between expectation and mandatory. First of all, I think there's quite a wide gulf between the two. I think we're quite a long way from understanding whether this is going to be something that is expected as well. So probably one for another day.
We need to be cautious about anything that we mandate across the sector. I think it's fair to say that students have an expectation of a range of support out there. And I think what we should be looking to do, and I think that the approach that we're taking is to give institutions essentially a toolkit of ways of supporting students and identifying students, whether that's through the UCAS application, whether that's through later declaration, whether that's through analytics, etc. So for me, this is a part of a broader toolkit that the institutions have at their disposal. I don't necessarily think any one part of that should or could be mandated, because different institutions will have different contexts.
Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, my name is Joan Kincannon, and I'm Director of External Relations and Director of the York Festival of Ideas at the University of York. My blog spells out the critical need for universities to engage imaginatively and interactively with local and global communities. In doing so, we can combat the rising narrative questioning the intrinsic value of universities to society. Since 2011, the University of York has led and coordinated the York Festival of Ideas. This year, we delivered more than 230 free events, with an overall increase in audiences of 50% compared to last year. Audiences want to engage with universities, but we have to do it on their terms, speak their language, find creative ways of exciting people about the relevance of what we do and why. Why does this matter? Because trust, once lost, is incredibly difficult to regain. This government has made clear that locally led economic growth, where, to quote the PM, communities have skin in the game, offers a major chance for universities to reset our contribution. And it starts with accessible and meaningful conversations with those communities about what we do.
Now, the Renters' Rights Bill is back in Parliament and its implication for students. Ben, walk us through it, please.
So thank you, Mark. So this was obviously picked up in the Wonky Daily this morning, but many of you will be aware that the Renters' Rights Bill has passed its second reading through the Commons yesterday. And you'll also recall that previous legislation was brought forward by the Conservative government, but they essentially ran out of time on that one. In terms of why is this important to the students? So the student market makes up a sizable proportion of the rental market. So 1.3 million students living in the private rented sector. And that's probably an underestimate when you consider students that are living at home within the private sector as well. In terms of what's within it, so it looks to bring an end to no-fault evictions, and also has a number of clauses in there in relation to the student rental market. But PBA ISAs themselves are relatively untouched. We've seen a bit of back and forth through this, but one of the things that we do see is that bringing, you know, that end of tenancy with 2 months' notice. Now, that has raised concerns amongst landlord groups that think it may impact on the supply of opportunities for students. And obviously, that is a key thing that we need to safeguard, that to ensure there is a high quality stock there available for students. But actually, one of the things that we saw at the end of the session yesterday in the Commons was Matthew Pennycook talk about the further consideration needed to be given to the student angle and opening the door to further conversation in that space.
Jenny, it's one of these classic things, isn't it? We talk about this on the podcast all the time, where students get forgotten about because it's, you know, it's not in, they're not responsibility of DfE, but not responsibility of the, you know, the Ministry for Housing, etc., etc. And it gets sort of bounced around and falling through the cracks.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that it has been thought about. I think it is right to exempt PBSA from this new legislation. It would, or some of the clauses anyway, because it would just break the model. It would create a lot of chaos. It would not be good for students. Also, it's quite complex because it's not, you know, the distinction between university housing and PBSA is increasingly a bit hazy with a lot of nomination agreements, joint ventures and so on. So I think that's correct. It is a little bit kind of sketchy in terms of, sketchy is not the right word, vague is a better word. In terms of the shared houses, with the idea that yes, a tenant can give notice and a landlord can give notice, but generally it's going to happen at the normal time in the summer. So it does feel like it's sort of trying to bend itself a little bit out of shape to deal with the student market.
I mean, do you get other more systemic issues in the student rental market than this bill really touches on?
Oh, there absolutely are, Mark, because I think everybody on this podcast knows. I mean, I was struck by, and this is in Jim's corner on the site if you want to read along, I was struck by Alex Sobel's contribution to the debate. He is the Labour MP for Leeds Central and Headingley, which is a huge student district. So he's talking about research from the NUS that suggests that students are dropping out because of the cost of rent. He's noting that accommodation prices have increased by 61% since 2012. He's talking about the incoming phenomenon that is 100% deposits, where students are asked to pay their complete accommodation fees up front. Mm. It is getting worse out there, I think partially because demand is getting tighter. Mm. And demand is getting tighter primarily because we have had unconstrained expansion of the higher education sector, which has been focused particularly in places that already are large student cities. Now, the argument as to whether or not we want uncontrolled expansion of the higher education sector is one for a different day. There are points on either side. But if it is going to be expanding, we need to know as soon as possible where students are going to be. And that's a question that almost comes round to Ben and UCAS, in that we need a lot earlier data on where undergraduate students and indeed postgraduate students, which is that study or ambit, are actually taking up places. We need to know a long way in advance. If you know 6 months in advance that there is going to be an accommodation crunch, you can do something about it. If you know six days or 6 weeks in advance, it's probably less likely you can actually put any kind of fix into the place. So we really need to know where students are going to study as soon as possible. This needs to be shared with the local and regional authorities that are making accommodation plans. And then we need to just put the student first, basically, and think about student housing needs.
I think for me, we know that accommodation is a key part of that overall student experience. experience. And if we are to move towards a student success model in relation to access and participation, students need to be confident that there is a range of accommodation and high quality accommodation out there for them. And I agree with you, DK. I think understanding trends in demand it plays a key part of that. I'm really interested in the other side of this because, you know, in recent years, we've heard a lot around, are more students thinking about living at home during their studies? And what we've seen is that students generally are more interested in living at home. And roughly speaking, 1 in 3 students live at home during their studies, 1 in 4 UK 18-year-olds. So that general perception of packing up the car in September, jumping on the motorway and coming back 3 years later, for 1 in 4 18-year-olds, that's not the case. But actually, when you start looking at background, you see a very different picture, because for quintile 1 students, it's over half of UK 18-year-olds are living at home during their studies, compared to less than 10% at quintile 5. So you have a real difference there in terms of student experience and that mobility based on background as well. And I think for me, that is an area that we need to give focus to as well and consider more. Like I said, during cost of living, we have seen a growing interest in living at home. We haven't seen an explosion or a change in behavior from students. I know some institutions have seen changes, but generally speaking, it's about 1 percentage point a cycle that we're seeing. But those stark differences by background, I think, is something that require further discussion.
That's so interesting, Ben, particularly the difference in the polar quintiles. It almost takes us back to Robbins and the whole idea of student grants in the first place, which is that anyone who wants to move away to study should be able to afford to do that. And obviously now we've got this massive sector compared to then, and it's hard to sustain that. But really interesting what you said as well, DK, about having a little bit more notice to be able to kind of manage the supply and demand. But it's quite hard to turn on and off the supply and demand for student housing, because sometimes you just need to build more stuff, or you need to, you know, make sure that the landlords are still in the market, and you can't necessarily do that over a short time. And you know, I think we've all had conversations over the last few years about what would it look like if we had a post results admission cycle. And I think we've always said in the student accommodation sector, it would be quite chaotic. And you know, more students now coming through clearing, you've got a lot of changes at the last minute, and lots of, you know, very rapid demand on housing stocks. So the other thing to say as well, you know, we've got a market in higher education. We've created a market for higher education, and it's acting as a market, and it's can't put the genie back in the bottle now.
And you are starting to see the market shift. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing more and more students being placed through mm-hmm. clearing. So 1.2% up this cycle. But we're also seeing the biggest active pool in clearing are the group of students that proactively put themselves mm-hmm. there through using something called Decline My Place. And I've just come back from a conference called the International Association of Admissions Organizations, which isn't the easiest acronym to say, but essentially it's shared admission services across the globe. And what they're all reporting is that students are leaving decisions later, but also requiring more and more flexibility and changing their mind later. And we're certainly seeing that in the UK. We're certainly seeing that in the UK 18-year-old cohort. And that has a pressure on student accommodation, doesn't it?
The other angle on this that's not in the bill, which arguably should be, is the quality of accommodation. Now, naively, as a 90s kid, I thought that things had got a lot better since I was at university. I mean, I once had floorboard collapse in my student bedroom of a rented house, which dropped a large oak wardrobe on my head, which on reflection, I thought it was hilarious at the time, but actually probably could have killed me. I keep seeing these reports of student houses in a poor state of repair, with mold, with all kinds of other problems, and I can't understand how that is still possible. I think the student accommodation market has become a lot more stratified. If you can afford it, you've got some very nice purpose-built student accommodation with your gyms and your cinema and all that. But at the other end of things, if you can't afford to pay those prices, and as Ben has made clear, not everybody can do that, you need to live away from, you are faced with some quite terrifying accommodation options. Now, for me, if you are actually renting a property out to anybody, it should meet certain minimum requirements. And I believe that is actually a matter of law these days. But it's still shocking to me how few student properties actually manage to meet those requirements. And surely if we're legislating about rented accommodation, the quality of rented accommodation has to be a factor.
I think, as I said before, I think the role of accommodation as part of that overarching student experience and approach to student success, I think, is increasing. And I think within that, students have an expectation that there will be accommodation available, but equally that accommodation will be of a sufficient quality as well, as you say, whether that's a baseline, whether that's legislated or through other means. But I think you're right. Given that the importance of accommodation in the overarching student experience, there should be a level of quality there that students can expect.
Okay, so let's wrap this one up here.
Now, every week this season, we're having a think about how things were and how things came to be. With City St George's Academic Registrar Mike Ratcliffe, here's a hidden history of higher education.
In the 2017 Conservative Manifesto, there was an interesting development whereby we saw the proposal for new institutes of technology. And these, described in the proposal back then, were to have Regius professors and have degree awarding powers and to be very grand places. I'm not sure that we've quite got to that stage with the Institutes of Technology yet. But they look rather similar to another proposal from a Conservative government, but in this case, 50 years earlier. The Colleges of Advanced Technology were a way of pulling out from the succession of regional colleges of technology a group that would be advanced and would do higher level work. And so David Eccles, who was the education minister, presents a white paper on technical education in 1956, which says that all of the work in technical education, or a bulk of it, should be concentrated in a small number of colleges. The rationale was so that they built up a sufficient critical mass and that students would need to go to them. And the technical colleges would each have a specialisation that they could work to, and that people would, you know, would coalesce around them. So all pretty similar to where we are now in terms of the development of the Institutes of Technology. And these are very familiar places. So the white paper sets out the kinds of places that might become them. And so the Acton Technical College becomes the Brunel College of Advanced Technology, which becomes Brunel University. And so we go through this process of seeing how those places develop. Now, some of them who were on the original list in the white paper don't get to be colleges of advanced technology. So that the Leicester College of Technology and Commerce doesn't come through, doesn't get to be a CAT, but of course it eventually becomes De Montfort University. So those developments happen over time, and we see that. Now, obviously, this gives some of those universities a head start. These are universities that have chancellors, and they have charters, and they have got 25 years of UGC funding rather than the other places that they had. But sometimes this didn't work out for them at all. So one of the places that actually became a College of Advanced Technology, Chelsea, although it was destined to move to St Albans, it never did. It fell through in its negotiations and then merged with King's College, and all traces of it have effectively vanished. Obviously, graduates of it won't appreciate that, but effectively it's vanished. It's one of those places that have now closed. So the CATs themselves developed some very important things, which actually will become features of the rest of the sector. Firstly, they weren't given their own degree awarding powers. They had to work for a Council for Technological Awards, which set a new form of qualification that they would all have, the Diploma of Technology. This was to be at degree standard and with the same official standing, but it would have a kind of pattern that they would all adhere to. The key thing was that it would have a sandwich approach. Every student would go out and do work placement. That was a mandatory part of the course. But it also have other distinctive features, such as a liberal studies programme. So all the students had to do humanities and other studies alongside it. So those things set off in their way. And clearly, these are the challenger institutions of their time, picked by government to advance a technological mission. They continue to develop that work. What happens to them, of course, is that by the time Robbins comes along, Robbins decides they should all become technological universities, or he says they might become faculties of technological universities next door, because quite often they're in the same city. So there's then a process whereby they become universities, and some of them go through a further transformation at that point. So that what had been at Borough moves out and becomes the University of Surrey, and what had been in Bristol, the Virtue and Venturers College, moves out to Bath and becomes the University of Bath, but they become technological universities, and they proceed happily in a different direction, although they've all now quietly dropped the technological university tag, but that's where they all come from, that early boost of we shall have colleges of advanced technology, but they've all become wonderful and fine universities.
Now, finally this week, Labour has committed to reviewing the international education strategy. Jenny, what's going on?
Yeah, as you say, Mark, the new government has announced that it's going to review the international education strategy. It's not terribly old. The original one was launched in 2019 by the Conservative government, and it did follow, as we all know, a decade of significant growth in international students and also, of course, some year-to-year volatility in terms of policy changes and political rhetoric. So it was an interesting time. Something that makes me smile is that there was this goal in the strategy of 600,000 international students by 2030. And certainly I at the time, and I'm sure there's thought, oh, that looks great. That's quite ambitious. It was reached in 2020, so just 1 year on. And we've just been overshooting it ever since then. It was also followed by some welcome changes to the visa process, particularly the ability for graduates to stay for an additional 2 years. But we have as well seen a harder line taken on the dependent visas, which have affected some markets. So it's been quite a ride. So looking forward, it's good to hear that it's going to be in safe hands with Professor Steve Smith, who's just been reappointed as the International Education Champion. And I think we're just all waiting to see what the new strategy will say.
So I think this is a hugely interesting area. As I said, I've just come back from the International Association of Admissions Organizations conference, and international student recruitment was a hot topic at that session. And what you're seeing is different approaches across the globe. So nations like Canada and Australia becoming more restrictive, and even Norway becoming more restrictive in their recruitment of international students. And nations like Germany looking to really ramp up their recruitment of international students as a result of an aging population. I also think global geopolitics has a role in an influence in that market. So I was recently in Istanbul and met 70 to 80 teachers and advisors there. Now, people who follow UCAS data will know that for the last couple of cycles, Turkey has been the largest growth nation for UK higher education. And I asked the question to those teachers and advisors, why is that? Why are we seeing an increased demand for UK higher education? And what they said to me is essentially there is a weakening demand for US provision for a number of reasons. And I think also a growing recognition of the value of the world-class offer that the UK delivers in a three-year time period. And I think one of the things that as the UK we can shout about more is that UK higher education gets you to where you want to go quicker compared to a common four-year model across the globe. And I think when you look at that across an increasingly more expensive domestic offer in Turkey as well, the UK offer becomes much more attractive. And I think one of the things I would be really keen to see in the next international education strategy is a promotion of the point that the UK can get you to where you want to go to quicker.
It's so true, isn't it? I remember all the debates, gosh, in the 90s and 2000s around, we're out of line with it. Was it the Bologna Treaty or something like that? I don't know, but everyone else does 4 years. We do 3 years and we're very efficient. But just sort of piling on, I was very struck, obviously, by a lot of references to accommodation in Jim's piece. And I think he's absolutely right. I think also, though, that this is something that institutions that recruit a lot of international students and have greater sort of ambitions in this space are very, very acutely aware of. I think that the UK has probably more of a developed student accommodation market than other European countries. So I've always been struck by how, once you go out of the UK, PBSA, student accommodation, is really for international students only, whereas we've got this, very sort of long-standing tradition of domestic students moving away as well. So I think arguably we've got more supply and more flexibility in that system than other European countries. Having said that, I'm a big believer in certainly citywide strategies, and I think it's something that universities are very motivated to do because they know if they can't offer suitable housing, it's going to affect their recruitment.
And I think one of the things that we've seen is international students starting to understand the full breadth of provision that is available in UK higher education at an undergraduate level. So moving away from London, moving away to a broader range of courses as well. And again, one of the things I would be keen to see in any future international education strategy is a complete view of the UK's offer and how we can promote that to students.
Yeah, the thing that strikes me about this is that an international education strategy could go in one of two ways. It could, and I think some of the international exemplars that Jim highlights, it could be what is basically an education strategy. It could deal with the good that international education can cause, or it could be purely an industrial strategy. Now, the last version had two targets. It's got the 600,000 target, which everybody knows about, which has been met. It also had the target that it would bring in £35 billion worth of imports, exports, in fact, apologies. And that is a lot of cash. That is a big contribution to the UK economy. So in some ways, it's always going to be an industrial strategy. And it is possible to imagine a situation where we focus entirely on the kind of things that have the highest margins and the lowest cost. I mean, one thing I'd like to see more of in a strategy is on transnational education and on online provision transnationally. I think there's a potential for huge growth in that part of the market. It neatly cuts across the concerns about capacity and the concerns about immigration that you hear from all sides of the political spectrum. And it could also do a reasonable job of the kind of soft power stuff. I mean, obviously, there are always going to be some international students that want to come and study in the UK. I mean, not just for the study experience, but for the experience of being in the UK. If you think of universities, you normally think of either UK or the US. The UK has got the older ones, and that's hugely attractive to a lot of people across the world who probably have a decent standard of English as a second language, who may have done chunks of their education in English already, as it is increasingly common about the world. But the big decision that the government needs to make here is it going to focus on the financials, or is it going to focus on the international student experience? What are international students actually doing? What are they contributing? I mean, I see no reason why we can't improve the availability of international student work placements, international student volunteering, stuff like that. It's a choice that needs to be made, and without any information, I'm really interested to see on which side of the coin DfE lands.
I think we should make more of the, it's more than just financial. The financial point is a point well made, but the benefits to UK higher education from international student recruitment go beyond that.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.